Welcome to your deep dive. Today, we're going to be looking at some excerpts from Dr. Robert Chisholm's lecture series on 1 and 2 Samuel.
Right.
Specifically, what he calls Saul's finest hour. And Samuel confronts the people. It's a fascinating look at King Saul's greatest victory.
Yeah.
And what it reveals about leadership, security, and the complex relationship between a people and their God.
It really highlights, I think, the timeless questions about, you know, where true security comes from and what it truly means to lead ideas just as relevant now as they were thousands of years ago.
Absolutely. So to set the scene, we're picking up right after Saul, Israel's first king, has been anointed.
Right.
Remember, the Israelites wanted a king,
thinking
it would solve all their problems and keep them safe?
Yeah.
But things aren't quite that simple, are they?
Not at all. This desire for security, I think, through human leadership is something that resonates throughout history, isn't it?
Yeah.
We often look to external sources for stability, but this story reminds us that true security might lie elsewhere.
Yeah. And speaking of security, chapter 11 throws us right into a crisis.
Okay.
We meet Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, who decides to lay siege to the Israelite town of Jabesh-Gilead.
Right.
But he doesn't just want to conquer.
No.
He offers them a treaty with a truly disturbing condition.
He demands to gouge out the right eye of every single inhabitant.
Wow.
It's a brutal tactic meant not only to weaken them physically, but to completely humiliate and demoralize the entire nation.
You can't help but wonder what was going through the minds of those people trapped inside the city.
Right.
It's a pretty terrifying situation.
And strategically brilliant.
Yeah.
He bypasses a long siege and makes a devastating statement about who holds the power.
Right.
The elders of Jabesh-Gilead, in a desperate attempt to buy some time, managed to negotiate 7 days to seek help.
Okay. And that's where this gets intriguing. Knowing their history. The messengers head straight for the territory of the tribe of Benjamin, Saul's tribe, and specifically to his hometown, Gibeah. Now, you might be wondering why they'd go to Benjamin.
It's a fascinating detail, Dr. Chisholm points out.
Yeah.
You see, Jabesh-Gilead and the tribe of Benjamin have a long history, dating back to the events of the Book of Judges.
Right.
There was a conflict that almost wiped out the Benjaminites.
Oh, wow.
And Jabesh-Gilead played a crucial role in helping the tribe recover.
Interesting.
So in their time of need, they turn to those connected to their city's survival.
So it speaks to the enduring power of shared history.
Right.
And the bonds that unite people, even across generations.
Yeah.
So the messengers arrive in Gibeah.
Yeah.
And it's pure panic. Not exactly what you'd want to welcome a newly appointed king with.
Indeed. And Saul.
Yeah.
Who we find is returning from working in the fields,
doesn't
exactly fit the image of a powerful, confident monarch. Not quite the kingly entrance you might expect.
No, not the regal figure people might have envisioned.
Right.
But here's where things shift dramatically. Hearing the news.
Yeah.
Saul is filled with the Spirit of God. And suddenly, this hesitant, almost reluctant king takes decisive action.
Oh, wow.
It's almost like witnessing the spirit of Gideon, the biblical judge, come alive again.
It's a powerful transformation.
Yeah.
He channels this newfound energy, rallying the tribes with a bold move.
Okay.
He cuts a pair of oxen into pieces and sends them throughout Israel.
Oh, my goodness.
Warning those who don't join him, and Samuel will face the same fate.
It's a pretty dramatic gesture.
Well,
what do you make of it?
Dr. Chisholm makes a brilliant observation.
Yeah.
In the Book of Judges, body parts were sent as a declaration of vengeance and a call to civil war.
Oh, right.
Saul uses the same dramatic act.
Yeah.
But this time, it's to unite the tribes against a common enemy.
Yeah.
Signaling a new era for Israel. He's not just echoing past leadership models. He's innovating on them.
So it's fascinating how he uses this symbolic act to shift the narrative.
Yeah.
To create a sense of unity and purpose.
And the people respond.
Yeah.
The fear sparked by this display, coupled with the threat of a common enemy, ignites a sense of national unity. They rally behind Saul, and he quickly amasses a large army.
Yeah.
This farmer-turned-king becomes a force to be reckoned with.
So here we have Saul leading this massive army to confront Nahash. You might expect him to be a bit hesitant, considering this is his first real test as king.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But what we see is a leader who has not only embraced his role, but also learned from the past. He utilizes a tactic we've encountered before, dividing his forces into three divisions, much like Gideon did against the Midianites.
Ah, so he's not just drawing on symbolism, but also on practical military strategies.
Precisely. And it results in a stunning victory. He launches a surprise attack on the Ammonites under the cover of night, catching them completely off guard. The Ammonites are routed, scattered, utterly defeated.
Wow, what a moment. Saul's first major victory as king. I imagine he must have felt incredibly vindicated, especially considering those who doubted him early on.
It's a moment ripe with opportunity. He could easily use this victory to consolidate his power, maybe even punish those who questioned his leadership back in chapter 10. But what's striking is his response. Saul declares that no one will be put to death, recognizing that the Lord has rescued Israel.
That's quite a statement, especially coming from a newly established king.
It is. And it underscores a critical theme that Dr. Chisholm highlights throughout the lecture series. True security comes from God, not from human kings. At the height of his triumph, Saul acknowledges that the victory isn't about him. It's about God's power and faithfulness.
It's almost a counterintuitive approach to leadership, isn't it? He's not bolstering his position through force or intimidation, but through an act of grace.
Exactly. It's a subtle but powerful message that resonates with the people. Now, while Saul's experiencing this incredible victory, we can't forget about Samuel. He's been a guiding figure for Israel, and he seizes this opportunity to do more than just formally renew Saul's kingship at Gilgal.
He's not going to let this moment pass without imparting some wisdom, is he?
He's a wise leader who understands that victories can sometimes obscure deeper truths. He knows the Israelites have a tendency to forget the source of their blessing, so he gathers them together. He reminds them that, yes, they have their king, but that doesn't change the fundamental reality. Their security, their well-being, ultimately depends on their relationship with God.
So getting what they demanded a king doesn't mean they're off the hook in terms of their responsibilities to God.
Not at all. And to really drive this point home, Samuel does something extraordinary. He calls down a thunderstorm during the wheat harvest season, no less.
Talk about a dramatic gesture. I mean, that's not just some light rain, that's a sign from God. What a powerful way to get their attention.
It's a demonstration of divine power that leaves the people both awestruck and terrified. Imagine the impact of witnessing such a display. Suddenly, they're confronted with the gravity of their demand for a king. They had, in essence, rejected God as their ruler, hadn't they?
So the thunderstorm isn't just a weather event. It's a symbolic reminder of their choices and the consequences that come with them.
And their reaction is telling. They're filled with fear, realizing they've made a grave mistake. They beg Samuel to intercede on their behalf, terrified of God's judgment. It's here that we see another fascinating aspect of Samuel's role. He's not just a prophet or a judge. He's also an intercessor, much like Moses.
Oh, I see the connection. He's standing between the people and God, pleading for their forgiveness.
Exactly. He embodies his complex role, demanding accountability while also offering compassion. It speaks to the multifaceted nature of true leadership, doesn't it? The ability to both challenge and guide, to hold people responsible while also extending grace.
It's a model of leadership that seems particularly relevant today, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Where we often see a focus on either authority or empathy, but rarely both.
I couldn't agree more. So Samuel prays for the people, urging them to recommit to God, to truly understand what it means to serve him faithfully. He reminds them of all that God has done for them, the incredible acts of deliverance, the constant provision. He's giving them a chance to reset, to choose a different path.
It makes you think about the kind of leadership we need today, one that combines strength with humility, accountability with compassion. It's not just about achieving victory, but understanding what that victory represents, where it truly comes from.
Precisely. And the story of Saul's finest hour highlights something Dr. Chisholm emphasizes throughout his lectures. The idea that true leadership isn't just about wielding power. It's about recognizing a power greater than yourself.
And that even when we make mistakes, even when we stray from what truly matters, there's a path back. That's a pretty hopeful message, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Samuel's willingness to intercede for the people even after they essentially rejected God's leadership speaks volumes about the possibility of forgiveness and renewal. It's a reminder that we're not defined by our missteps, that we have the capacity to learn, to grow, to reorient ourselves towards what's truly important.
It's a powerful reminder for all of us, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we're not off the hook just because we have leaders, whether they're kings, presidents, or even CEOs. Ultimately, we each have a responsibility to cultivate our own relationship with what guides us, with what gives us a sense of meaning and purpose.
And this story, though, set in ancient Israel, speaks to us across time and cultures. It reminds us that the human desire for security, for stability, for a sense of belonging is something we all grapple with. And often we look for those things in external sources, in power, in systems, in human leaders. But what this story so beautifully illustrates is that true security, true peace, might come from a different source entirely.
It's fascinating how Dr. Chisholm weaves together these different threads: leadership, faith, the nature of security, and shows how they're all interconnected. What stands out to you the most from this deep dive? Was it the stark brutality of Nahash's demands, or maybe Saul's unexpected transformation from hesitant leader to decisive warrior?
What I find particularly thought-provoking is the way Samuel uses that incredible display of power, the thunderstorm, in the middle of the harvest season to shake the Israelites out of their complacency. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? If Samuel were alive today, what kind of thunderstorms would he use to get our attention? What would it take to make us pause to really confront our choices and priorities?
That's a powerful question to ponder, isn't it? What kind of wake-up call would it take for us to reevaluate our lives, to turn back towards what truly matters? It's a challenge to consider both individually and collectively. And it's precisely the kind of challenge that Dr. Chisholm invites us to engage with through his lectures.
It's about more than just understanding the historical narrative. It's about applying those timeless lessons to our own lives, our own struggles, our own search for meaning and purpose.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Saul's finest hour. We hope it's left you with some new insights, some thought-provoking questions, and maybe even a renewed sense of inspiration. Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.